Today on Maine Calling, climate expert Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson, who wants to reframe our approach to the future. It's easy to list the discouraging evidence of Earth's climate crisis, severe hurricanes and wildfires, warming oceans, and the spread of insect-borne diseases. For many people, what's happening feels overwhelming and apocalyptic. But Professor Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson wants us to stop with the doomsday talk and reframe how we talk about our planet and its climate. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Dr. Johnson, who teaches at Bowdoin College, has a new book out. It's titled, What If We Get It Right? Visions of Climate Futures. Johnson believes we already have the tools and knowledge to avoid a catastrophic future. Today on Maine Calling, she shares her vision of realistic solutions to the climate crisis. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible by support from Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn more at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. Welch and Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth. From investments to trustee services, more at welchforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. What does it mean to get to the other side of the climate crisis? What action is called for, and is it realistic? Well, today's guest tackles these questions in her new book. Joining me, Dr. Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson, a marine biologist and RUE Distinguished Scholar at Bowdoin College. She is also the co-founder of Urban Ocean Land, and her book that everyone is talking about is What If We Get It Right? Visions of Climate Futures. Welcome, Dr. Johnson.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
We invite you to join the conversation. Do you feel optimistic or despondent about addressing climate change? What do you do to make a difference? What do you hope others will do? Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Congratulations on the book. It's making quite a splash. I've seen you on the NewsHour, PBS NewsHour, and read about you in the New York Times, Ayanna. It's just fantastic. It occurs to me as I read through your book and I think about this topic that so many of us seem to fall somewhere on a spectrum. On the one end, there are climate skeptics who still resist the science of climate change. On the other side of the spectrum, the other end, the people who are suffering climate anxiety, who feel crippled by doom. My sense is that you want to reframe this, maybe get us off this spectrum altogether.
In a sense, yes. I mean, I think the opportunity here is just to twofold. One, to imagine a climate future we actually want to live in, and then figure out what our individual roles are in helping to make that dream real. And I think it's important to say that we have the climate solutions we need. That's something a lot of people don't think about as the baseline of all of this, right? We know how to electrify transportation. We know how to green our buildings. We know all different ways to improve agriculture and our food systems. We know how to have clean energy and how to protect and restore ecosystems. It's not like there's a big secret or we need to wait for some fancy new technology. It's really just a matter of how quickly and how justly we're going to implement these solutions that are already at our fingertips. And so I really just want people to start with that as a baseline. And of course, as I'm a scientist, I don't want to sugarcoat the really dire projections, and the climate changes that Maine is already experiencing are significant. But it's just to say we need to not only look at the problems, we need to look at the possibilities as well for what we can do about it and not just resign ourselves to the worst possible future by doing nothing.
I think so many of us feel so small in this fight that, you know, we may compost and recycle and maybe drive an electric car and Maybe we've switched to heat pumps in our home. Even Maine, ahead of its climate goals, with the number of heat pumps being installed around
Maine
the
is
state.
the number one in the nation on heat pump adoption. It really is so impressive, especially because so many people said they won't be effective enough in cold weather. So in many ways, Maine is proving people wrong and leading on this, which is really wonderful to see.
And I guess my thought is that whether it's as an individual or as a state, it still feels pretty small. It means, you know, 1.3 million people in a state of 320 million in a world of billions. Tell us why we ought not feel like our actions are almost irrelevant.
I think it's really important to always keep in mind the different levels of impact and influence that we can have, right? There's what we do in our own households, which when we all do those things certainly adds up, the same way that our votes add up and matter. If everyone felt like their votes wouldn't matter, then who knows what would happen with the outcome of elections. But if we all only are thinking about what we do in our own homes or in our own personal lives, then we're missing the opportunity for these larger circles of impact. And one of the things that's really exciting about what Maine has been trying to do with the Climate Council and the reports that are coming out and the recommendations is that Maine can actually be an example of what getting it right looks like for other states. You know, Maine can be an influencer, a climate influencer in a good way, right? There is a lot of information that is shared from state to state and country to country on what's working, and how we can repeat each other's successes and avoid each other's failures. So, absolutely, it matters what Maine does and what we do as individuals. It, in some sense, with the heat pump example, right? We're proving them wrong. We're saying it actually does work here. It is something people are interested in. It, you know, that these clean energy options are practical and affordable, and just make good common sense. And I think that's what more and more people are being attracted to climate solutions by. Oh, this is actually efficient. This is saving money. This is good for my family, right? This is good for clean air and clean water in my community. And that's the shift I think we need to get people into that new mindset.
A phrase that's thrown out around a lot in the discussion about climate change is tipping point. And a lot of people believe that we're already past this tipping point and that we're, you know, doomed. And how do you think about that? How do you talk to people who say, why does it even matter?
I think that's an understandable feeling. I mean, we see a lot of really dire news, the scientific projections. There are some very, very bad possible futures. And so I think people who feel that way, like, I get it. I feel it sometimes too. But the way that all of this works is that there are so many different possible futures. It's not like we either win or lose. It's not some binary thing. We have apocalypse on one hand and paradise on the other. It really is innumerable possible outcomes. And there's never going to be a point at which we're done as a species working on how we can live in harmony with all the other species on this planet. And I find that really helpful to remind myself that it's not like there's a point at which we just give up, because it could always actually get worse, which is maybe not reassuring, but it could also always get better. And so I think that's how I approach this, is what can I do to contribute to having the best possible outcome? Because if we think of it as a range from 0 to 100, it actually really makes a difference whether we get 60% of the way to all the solutions that we have or 90%, say. We're talking about the lives and livelihoods of 8 billion people and so many millions of other species on the planet. So it doesn't really make sense to give up on life on Earth, would be my pitch to that person.
And speaking of life on Earth and the fact that you're a scientist, talk to us about Earth's healing ability. I mean, what do you see could happen if we, to use the title of your book, get it right?
One of the things I think gets left out of this conversation a lot is the importance of photosynthesis and ecosystems and the ability of nature to absorb and rebalance the carbon cycle, the water cycle, the nitrogen cycle. These are all dynamic systems on the planet that we've really thrown out of whack. And the more we can look to nature for solutions, I think the better off we'll be. We know the ocean, for example, holds about a third of the climate solutions we need, from offshore wind energy, which is up and coming in Maine, to sustainable seafood like oysters and seaweed. Also, Maine is doing incredible work on that front, to thinking about decarbonizing shipping and fisheries, to restoring and protecting coastal ecosystems. There are just so many ocean climate solutions that haven't been getting globally the attention that they deserve. And the same, ocean ecosystems, for example, can absorb 5 or 10 times more carbon per acre than a forest on land. So those eelgrasses really deserve a lot more love, I would say. And I think that's what we're mostly leaving out of the conversation in favor of talking about technology.
Yeah, and that's something I wanted to talk about. We did do a whole entire main calling on eelgrass as well as on phytoplankton and its role and what the Bigelow Lab is learning about its role in the climate future. But I'm really interested in this. We focus so much on how technology might solve things, whether it's ocean wind farms, solar panels, heat pumps, high-speed trains. But you also focus on some very ancient ways of tackling climate change. And I'm wondering if you could just talk about these a little bit. What the way we live on the land might look like to help.
Well, there's a chapter in the book which is a conversation with Brian Donahue, who is Professor Emeritus from Brandeis University and who's been a farmer and forester since the 70s in Massachusetts and is an environmental historian about New England. And he's reminding us that New England really used to produce all of its own food. Maine is still, up on the top of the list in terms of the number of small farms. But that, while it's wonderful that we are over 90% forest, it didn't used to be that way. In fact, a lot of that is regrown after agriculture shifted to the Midwest. And so he and his colleagues are proposing that New England get back to more self-sufficiency in terms of our food system and in terms of our timber and pulp products, because we're importing so much wood from the Southeast in a region that has more forest than any other. It doesn't make a lot of sense. So he's really interested in what sustainable selective forestry looks like in New England, as well as what it would look like for us to be producing more of our own vegetables and dairy and meat again. And I think that's a really exciting opportunity to also, as he says, revitalize small towns that have been really heavily impacted by globalization and sort of the shift in our economy away from that regional self-sufficiency. So I think a lot of what the opportunity is for how we might live differently is actually getting back to Maine's roots in a lot of ways, things that we're nostalgic for anyway, but that's going to take some shifts in economy and policy. I know Congresswoman Pingree was speaking recently about our food system and the farm bill with restaurateurs and others in the industry recently, and there's just a lot of need for the farm bill to be supporting small farmers and climate-friendly practices instead of only funding sort of like the big commercial agriculture kind of corn fields type of stuff. So it's tricky because I know how hard it is for small farmers to make a living. My mother was a farmer for the last 20 years upstate New York with a small permaculture homestead. The margins are tight and it's so dependent on climate, right? The changes in when spring comes and the frosts and the deluges. I mean, Maine is seeing this increase in really heavy rains, and the storms last winter were really awful. And we can expect more of that to come. So we're going to need to not just romanticize the sustainable small-scale farming lifestyle, but actually support it with policies and funding as well.
You teach at Bowdoin, so you are exposed to the thinking of young people all day long. In fact, at the Common Ground Fair, some of your students came up to our producer, Cindy Hahn, and said, "You have to have our producer. You have to have our professor, Ayanna Johnson, on Maine Calling." So thank you to those students who suggested that. We already had you on
Yeah,
our
thank
radar.
you.
But I'm wondering, the young people I know, Ayanna, are really feeling discouraged, are considering not having children because they don't know what kind of world they will inherit. And
That's
I'm
very
wondering,
common. Yeah.
yeah, and I'm wondering if you're hearing that and how you talk to young people, the young people you see every day.
I mean, this was certainly a topic that came up repeatedly in my climate communications class at Bowdoin last year. I'm sure it will be something that comes up when I teach it again in the spring. And honestly, I have a lot of thinking to do about how to be more prepared to have that conversation with students because my personal disposition is just every morning wake up and think what I can do to be useful and not really worry too much about the outcome because I know that I can't control the future of climate or life on Earth, right? But I can contribute my piece to it. And so I, you know, but I have had two or more decades of thinking about this than they have and making peace with the fact that we don't know what the future will hold, but it's still worth the effort to make sure we have the best possible one. And life will go on. It's not as if our species is going to become extinct in a generation. It's just a matter of what kind of world our children and grandchildren are going to inherit. And climate anxiety, the recent studies are saying, is truly through the roof in young people. And it's absolutely across political affiliations. Independents, Democrats, Republicans, in their teens and 20s are all deeply concerned about climate change. A lot of them are thinking about not having children. It's absolutely shaping what careers and majors young people are choosing. And so we've had in my classroom a lot of conversations about what hope means in this moment. How they can still feel positive enough to keep going. Climate anxiety is one thing. Sometimes that anxiety can actually be motivating, but climate depression and despair are something else altogether. And I have a lot of sympathy, of course, for young people struggling with the really bad news and extreme dire scientific projections. And what I do is encourage them to, I guess, to quote Mr. Rogers, right? Look for the helpers. There are a lot of wonderful examples of people doing important, innovative, and effective work across the state and across the world. And I encourage them to look at that and think about how they can contribute to amplifying and accelerating those efforts. I think it's a lot of the anxiety comes from not knowing what we can do about it. And so helping young people and everyone think through, one thing I offer is this framework of trying to figure out your role in climate solutions by considering a Venn diagram of three circles. And the first is what are you good at? What can you bring to the table in terms of your skills, your resources, your networks? The second circle is what work needs doing. All of those climate solutions we have at our fingertips, including politics and culture as ways to unlock the ability to implement all the others. And the third circle is what brings you joy? Because if we consider working on climate solutions as the work of our lifetimes, we need to be able to keep going and not burn out because we're doing something that makes us miserable. And so if each of us find that sweet spot, are in the middle of our own climate action Venn diagram, then we'll be creating and living in a totally different world 5 or 10 years from now. And I find that to be actually super inspiring that if we can welcome each other into this work of climate solutions, there is actually an enormous amount we can do to make sure that we have a safer and healthier future.
Our guest today, Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson, the author of What If We Get It Right, also scholar at Bowdoin College. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Send us a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org, or find us on Facebook or Instagram. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Our guest today, Dr. Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson, author of What If We Get It Right? Visions of Climate Futures. She'll be at two upcoming events in Maine this Friday, October 25th. She will speak at USM's Hannaford Hall, and that's at 7 p.m. On Saturday, the next day, she will be at Blue Hill Congregational Church from 7 to 9 as part of the WORD, the Blue Hill Literary Arts Festival. Ayanna Johnson, a Bowdoin scholar, marine biologist, and policy expert. She's here to talk with us about her philosophy about climate solutions within our reach. Join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Send us an email, talk@mainepublic.org, or comment on Facebook or Instagram. We mentioned these events, Dr. Johnson. I understand you've had a bit of a variety show. These are not traditional. Not all of your events have been traditional book signings and readings.
Yeah. I'm actually quite an introvert and homebody. So it's been the thought of doing a book tour was a little bit terrifying to me. And I thought, well, if I have to do it, I mean, what's the point of writing a book if you don't tell people about it? How can I make this as fun for me as possible? Thinking that that might delight others, hopefully, as well. So yes, instead of reading my book aloud to you, although there is an audiobook if you would like that, I've been touring the country with my talented friends and colleagues, having conversations and dance-offs and hula-hooping and magicians and musicians, including the incredible Oshima brothers from the mid-coast of Maine, who have been, I think, on four or five tour stops with me. Our West Coast tour dates kind of synced up, and so we've had a lot of chances to collaborate there. I think it's important for me to remember that we can be so creative about how we approach this work of climate communication. And I've been seeing my role in the climate movement now as a welcomer. How do we welcome more and more people in to feeling like this is a place where they can belong, not just for a moment, but for their lifetimes, because it's energizing and exciting. And so, you know, apart from, of course, this conversation and getting to reach our friends and family and colleagues in Maine, I was most excited about the press for the book tour, that it was announced in Rolling Stone magazine as if it were like a rock band tour, with all of the tour stops listed, including Hannaford Hall, which is an event produced with Space, and the Literary Festival in Blue Hill as like tour stops. And that is because I've been collaborating with celebrities like Jason Sudeikis and Roy Wood Jr., magician Nicole Cardoza and artist Perrin Ireland, to have these kind of variety shows, and musicians like the Oshima Brothers and poets, to give us all these different entry points into thinking about and inspiring us on climate solutions. And I think, yeah, because I had to go on tour, I was like, how do we make this goofier, I guess, would be what was on my vision board. How do we take climate change seriously without taking ourselves seriously? Because I feel like the self-seriousness of it all is kind of off-putting. And there's actually been research that shows that when we use humor, we're able to let down our guards and let new information in a different way. And so, I don't know, maybe the world needs more climate jokes. It's certainly worth a shot. So we're bringing a lot of that energy to the event in Maine this Friday. And I hope, yeah, it looks like it's almost sold out. So if you don't have a ticket yet, now is the time to snag one. They're just a few dollars. Space is organizing that, as I mentioned. So we'll have the Oshima Brothers. We'll have you know, someone hula hooping and explaining how climate change is messing up the sex lives of other species and we really should get our act together for their sake. We'll have poetry. We'll have some discussion about the importance of voting for people who get it on climate solutions. Yeah, it'll be a lot of fun.
We'll go to Jamie calling from Portland. Hi, Jamie. Go ahead.
Oh, hi, Jennifer. Thank you for taking my call. Hey, so just to, sorry to get super serious here in this, in a way, but, you know, AI is generating a lot of interest and the power needs for it. The tech companies, to me, look like they're getting a bit of a hall pass because they're looking to restart and also create nuclear power, more nuclear power. And I'm all for, you know, different energy solutions. It's just the end point. The, you know, I see the talk and the investments, but the end point is the waste and what to do with it. And so I think the hall pass is, okay, you can do all these things, but what about taking care of the waste and your thoughts about nuclear power in this mix? Thank you.
This is Jamie, thanks for this question. I mean, you're bringing up two important issues. One is the role of nuclear and the other is AI and its incredible energy demands. In researching this book, I learned that not just AI, but data centers in general, right? All those emails and photos and streaming services are using an incredible amount of energy. So data centers in the United States consumed about 2.5% of our total electricity demand. But that was 2 years ago. It's increased since then. That is expected to triple to 7.5% by 2030. So we're on track to have 10% of our energy usage be data centers, which is wild to me. And AI is just increasing its energy usage at rates that are far beyond what people anticipated. And it's not just that it's using energy, it's also using a lot of water, actually. So I'm certainly concerned about that. I think so often when we think back to this original slogan of reduce, reuse, recycle, we ignore the first R in that, right? The reduce part. If we switch to cleaner energy and just use more and more and more and more of it, that actually doesn't solve the problem because even clean energy has impacts, right? Solar panels and wind turbines are made from things that are mined from the earth and that are affecting our landscape. So even if we do have a world powered fully on fusion, we're still going to need to be thoughtful about that. So I think the hall pass is not just for AI, it's for our energy usage in general, thinking that we can just be very reckless with it. And of course, you know, a lot of people are concerned about the amount of solar panels that are going to be blanketing our ecosystems if we're not also careful about conserving energy usage. So I just want to put in a plug for energy conservation as an overlooked solution. And when it comes to nuclear, this is not my particular area of expertise, I'll admit, but I do understand that there is a lot of innovation that's happened in nuclear technology over the past decades in terms of small scale nuclear reactors. The technology has shifted so that it's much safer in terms of shutdown. There's an interview in my book. I should mention the structure of the book is that it's largely based on interviews. There are 20 interviews in the book with all sorts of different experts who have helped me answer this title question. And there's an interview with Jigar Shah from the Department of Energy who talks about this opportunity for nuclear as a part of the mix. It is actually encouraging to see tech companies look to that because previously we've had coal plants and gas plants restart because of the energy needs of, say, cryptocurrency mining, which is absolutely a concern to think about how this sort of digital currency is a huge energy demand as well. But what Jigar Shah says is that we have to really think about it as an energy portfolio and a mix. We wouldn't want 100% solar or 100% wind, even if we could. So nuclear will have some role to play. It already does in some states more than others. And we have two nuclear plants that are coming back online that had been shut down. My personal opinion on nuclear is that shutting down safely operating plants, especially before we have clean energy to replace it with, is the worst option. And that's something that we've seen, shutting down nuclear plants and then firing up gas plants to meet that energy need. That is heading in the wrong direction. So I think it's also important to remember that building new nuclear facilities will take 5 or so years of permitting and design and another 5 or so years of construction. So it's not a quick fix. And so we just need to just be practical about the mix of energy solutions we're going to need and also think about energy conservation as well.
We'll go to David, who's calling from Scarborough. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hi. First of all, you are a rock star, and I really like your book. And I very much appreciate that the first poet that you've quoted is our favorite, Wendell Berry. But I love that. But I wanted to raise two things that are or a point that is raised in two of your interviews that is already an effective solution in Europe, in the UK, in Canada, and that satisfies your criteria of being just and quick and work at scale. And that is a carbon fee on the polluters with distributing the benefits to all citizens. And I just wanted to, as you address sort of this solution as a potential, put a couple things on the table about what will happen in 2025. We have to decide as a country whether we continue the tax cuts, the 2017 tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires, or do something different with them. We have to address the deficit or choose something that is not a taxing spend policy. And we also have to address the introduction of carbon border adjustment mechanisms from Europe as either a defensive or as a cooperative policy. So carbon fee and dividend, what do you think?
I think it's absolutely part of the portfolio of solutions we should be putting into place. Thank you for your thoughtful question and comment, and also for already having gotten through the book and read the Wendell Berry poem and noticed this mention in the text. I think there's been some historical resistance to carbon fee because of the lack of the dividend part, because it wasn't thought about as how do we distribute that in a way that's justly and doesn't make it a regressive tax on poor folks who, if they don't have access to cleaner energy options, are then just being taxed on their usage of oil and gas. So making sure that we are doing, yes, as you mentioned, in a way that is just is important. I think, you know, unfortunately, climate as an issue overall has gotten so absurdly polarized in the political landscape that passing a carbon fee and dividend will be very difficult. I think, you know, if we look at even just our state representatives in Maine, we have a lot of differences in how people are voting to support or not different environmental policies. I mean, Susan Collins has like a 13% rating from the League of Conservation Voters. She's not really voting for this stuff. Angus King, I think, is up there in the 80s% for last year and has been 90% before. Our members of Congress are also, their votes on the environment are evaluated on the League of Conservation Voters. I would suggest that everyone check that out as a resource for understanding how our state representatives are voting on these different issues that we care about and thinking about what it would look like to push them on this particular issue. But I will say just more broadly, these economic opportunities incentives for shifting our energy usage and environmental behaviors are in fact very important. And what we've had in the past 2 years with the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act was a lot of the incentive side, right? A lot of incentives for clean energy manufacturing, for battery plants, for offshore wind energy. But we haven't had for electric car manufacturing and adoption, for the incentives around electrifying our own homes. I put solar panels on my roof in Maine this year because there's a 30% tax credit for homeowners through the Inflation Reduction Act. And I also installed a heat pump hot water heater because there are huge tax credits available there. For people who aren't yet aware of that, I would say go to energy.gov/save to find out which of those tax credits as homeowners you might be eligible for. There's also ones for like insulating your home to make it more energy efficient, for windows and doors, for heat pumps, all of that kind of stuff, for induction stoves. So I hope people are taking advantage of that. But those are all the carrots part of it. You're talking about the sticks part, the fees for doing the bad stuff. And I think that's something that's been really hard to get the political will for in recent years. We've gotten close, you know, a decade or more ago, but it's been a while since we've been able to have enough bipartisan support for these kinds of measures to make progress on them. So it would be great if we can make it happen. And we as citizens and voters should continue to push our elected officials on that. But until that happens, we need to think about all of the other elements of it as well. I think there's no one thing that's going to get us there, but this is absolutely a part of that mix. It's just a matter of the political will, I think, on this one.
David, thanks for your call. We do need to take another quick break. We're speaking with marine biologist, Bowdoin scholar, and climate policy expert Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson. Her new book, What If We Get It Right? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. I'm talking with Ayanna Johnson about what our climate future might look like, depending on what our society does. Dr. Johnson is a marine biologist with Bowdoin. Her latest book, What If We Get It Right? Share your questions or comments. Email us at talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Kitsy, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Kitsy. Go ahead.
Hi. Hi, Jen. Ayanna, you are as wonderful a speaker as you are a writer. I'm so glad that you are doing these book tours, and I hope you get to do some of the speaking. When back in the late 80s and early 90s, I served a congregation in Vermont, and I got very involved with Bill McKibben, whom I'm sure you know well. And
yes, he's interviewed in the book.
Oh, okay. I haven't finished the whole book yet. I'm working through it, but I just love.
He was actually my professor in college for a seminar I took at Harvard back in like 1999. So been fan, now friend of Bill for a long time. He's a gem.
So you may know very well, and I don't know if he's changed this, but once upon a time, not that long ago, he was interviewed and he was asked, was he pessimistic or was he optimistic? And he said, mm-hmm. I am neither. I am choosing to stay engaged. And I took that as my mantra. I'm 86. I have two passions. One is to save the planet. The other is to save the democracy. And I give what energy and little money I can to both causes. But I just thought, staying engaged, you know, whatever it is. And my license plate says for joy. So I'm definitely into that. And I just thank you so much for this. And I'm so delighted you're in Maine. I hope you never leave Bowdoin. Thank you. I'll let you go. Take care. Be well.
Thank you so much. Gosh, I have so many thoughts on that. And one, maybe it's worth it to say, I mean, I moved to Maine almost 2 years ago now, exactly. And part of the reason was climate change. You know, my mother and I were thinking about where we wanted to live, consolidate our households. She just turned 80 and needed to stop farming. And I had the chance to come to Maine 2 Septembers ago and speak at the Island Institute's annual conference. And I was so inspired listening to all the incredible initiatives that are happening in Maine. How do we shift the lobster fishery off of fossil fuels? How do we deal with sea level rise? How do we adapt our agriculture? How do we support life and culture on the islands? And I just think Maine is such an incredible community of practical problem solvers. That when I had this job offer at Bowdoin, I thought, oh, these are my people, right? Just practical, how, what are we going to do about it? And I think that's what I think of when I think of Bill McKibben's approach, which has, I'm sure, influenced mine, which is not how can I be hopeful, but how can I be helpful? How can I be useful and not worry about optimism or pessimism, but just like, what do we do? How can we all roll up our sleeves together and collaborate? And so there's actually a chapter near the end of the book called A Note on Hope. Because I'm joyful, people confuse that with being hopeful. And I just feel like there's so much to enjoy about life and this planet without having any certainty about what the outcome of our efforts will be. And I've actually been thinking back on some of the ways that people talked about this work, this arc of work in the civil rights movement, and in particular, a quote from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. that said, "I may not get there with you," which was quite prescient of him, but also sort of obvious, right? Like, this is work of generations, whether we're thinking about civil rights or preserving democracy or environmental conservation. This is all work that we contribute to and don't determine the outcome or even necessarily see the outcome of. So it's so important to celebrate and appreciate the steps along the way, the progress that we're making, and think about progress over perfection, thinking about possibilities instead of just problems, and just encourage each other to keep going. I mean, Bill wrote the first climate book back in the 80s, I think. And this is just, and it's so wonderful to see this elder generation reactivate all of their energy from the 70s and activism and roots and with Bill's new organization that he's founded called Third Act. So to the listeners out there who are wondering how they can get involved, there are a bunch of different organizations I'd recommend. Third Act is one of them, motivating people in their third act of life, people who are worried about what kind of world they're leaving to their grandchildren, who have a bit of extra time on their hands, who are marching with banners that say fossils for fossils against fossil fuels, who are bringing their rocking chairs to protests outside of the big banks like Citibank, JP Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Wells Fargo. These are the banks that are still investing the most, $1 trillion a year, in the expansion of fossil fuels. So there's lots of ways to get involved and think about how we are moving our money into the places where we want to invest in climate solutions. I'm getting a little bit off the topic, but I think it's important to mention that that's actually probably the biggest impact most people can make as an individual, is making sure that our retirement savings are not invested in fossil fuels. There's some resources for that I would point out. Bankforgood.org and greenportfolio.com for finding climate-friendly investment and banking options. That's a super important thing. That could make more difference on your individual climate carbon footprint than all of the clean energy and good eating that we can do. So that one really matters.
Kitsy, thanks so much for calling in. We'll go to Steve, who's calling from Frenchville. And Ayana, if you don't know, Frenchville is in what we call the crown of Maine, right across the border from Canada. Hi, Steve, go ahead.
Yes, we're the last run of the St. John River before it hits Madawaska. I'm president of the Upper St. John River Organization. I'm a certified wildlife biologist, and we have recently started acquiring properties and working with local communities in Fort Kent and Frenchville to manage their forested properties. And what we're promoting is the development and maintenance of canopy, forest canopy. The state standards for upland wildlife habitat were until 2015, you had to have at least 75% canopy of at least 6-inch diameter trees, 30 to 35 feet tall is when you start getting to that condition. And of course, when you have a canopy, you're shading the ground. You can walk from the field into the forest and feel the difference from the mm-hmm. shade. And so now we do not have that. We don't have any objectives to develop or maintain canopy. Even the state of Maine Department of Conservation on our local public land conservation areas have conducted harvests with no regard in hydric soil, incidentally, with no regard or maintenance of canopy.
Steve, thank you so much for calling in, Ayanna. What do you think of future policy guidelines that would mandate forest canopy?
This is something I don't know very much about, but it's super interesting. The first the first section of my book, there's a chapter called Nature First, where I interview an environmental journalist who talks about the critical role of evapotranspiration as a cooling process, right? That trees are such an important part of the water cycle. It's not just their shade, but it's their the way that they move water is very important as a cooling function, and that trees can be like more efficient than air conditioners as a cooling source. And thinking about this is something that comes up a lot as a justice issue, because a lot of urban areas where more low income folks tend to have a lot less tree canopy, right? This is not just a forest and riparian stream side issue, but also an urban issue. Sometimes areas without trees in the city can be 10 degrees hotter, which as the climate is changing and we're having more heat waves, can start to put people at serious health risks. So I would just say also more trees in cities with a large canopy would be a great addition to that as well. And I know there's also been some really wonderful work happening in Maine about restoring the free flow of rivers to restore fish populations. So getting rid of some of those dams that aren't even being used anymore is another great initiative that's underway. As a board member of Patagonia, which one of our major environmental initiatives is free-running rivers, it's exciting to see progress on that. But of course, there's a lot more to be done on that one as well.
Steve, thanks so much for calling in. Ayanna, we are running out of time, and I don't want to end this conversation without asking you about Urban Ocean Land Lab. Excuse me, Urban Ocean Lab. Tell us about it.
Sure. So this is a policy think tank that I co-founded a few years ago to think about this intersection of oceans and climate and cities, because there actually wasn't an organization already that was working on this particular intersection, because coastal cities just face different climate challenges, as we've seen with the flooding and infrastructure issues that have come up in storms in just the last year in Maine. So we've been working on issues like offshore wind energy and working waterfronts and coastal ecosystem restoration and protection, because all of these are policy issues that we're going to need to think about. We just launched this year a resource hub that includes, it's open access. Anyone can check it out at urbanoceanlab.org. There are hundreds of resources vetted by our team, data sets, policy memos, example legislation, scientific papers, government reports, all pointing to climate solutions that coastal cities can engage in. So now that I'm finishing up my book tour, I'll really be hunkering down in Maine, not just because it's winter, but because I think it's important for all of us who live there to have a better understanding of the climate solutions that we can contribute to locally. And city governments are actually an underappreciated part of the climate solution, especially when it's so hard to get anything done at the federal level. It can be a real opportunity to think about how cities can lead the way on climate solutions. And so that's the work that Urban Ocean Lab is doing.
And when you say cities, are you talking about major cities? Are you talking about towns, small towns as well?
Cities and towns? Well, I mean, I think one of the things that's happening right now that has a lot of us completely captivated is, of course, this election, and the stakes could not be higher on climate. And we, you know, we have a climate denier running for president who has offered to sell environmental policy to the highest bidder, literally offered that if fossil fuel executives, Trump said if fossil fuel executives gave him $1 billion for his campaign, he would legislate on their behalf. And we have Harris, who signed the largest climate policy into law. But I'd
Professor
also say,
Johnson, I have to cut you off. We're out of time. But you wanted to say, please ask people running for local election what their positions are, right?
Absolutely. Check out leadlocally.org for more on that.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Wish we had more time. Dr. Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson, a marine biologist and RU Distinguished Scholar at Bowdoin College. She's co-founder, as we mentioned, of Urban Ocean Lab. She is appearing at Hannaford Hall this Friday and Blue Hill Literary Arts Festival this Saturday. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.